listening to On the Couch with Carly. Carly's couch is a safe space to talk. I'm a psychologist, but I'm not your pipe-smoking, tweed-wearing stereotype. So, welcome back to On the Couch with Carly. Today I have a special guest with me, Claire Van Dyck. Am I saying your name correctly?
Van Dyck.
That's more the Afrikaans pronunciation that I didn't get.
So I'm married an Afrikaans man and I got the Afrikaans surname. So I was previously Claire Williams and now sek mevrou Van Dyck.
So Claire Van Dyck is an HBSA registered counselor working for the Western Cape Department of Health. Claire offers private supervision for registered counselors and brings a strong interest in intersectional and social justice-focused research. Claire is passionate about creating space for complex, nuanced conversations, which I love, especially those without easy answers. Her professional work is grounded in public health with a commitment to accessible and equitable mental health care. Outside of work, she is married and shares life with her much-loved puppy. Claire values curiosity, critical thinking, and ongoing dialogue in both personal and professional spaces. And Claire is on this podcast because Claire asked to be on this podcast. So I'm so curious and looking forward to this conversation because Claire approached me and said she'd really like to bring up this topic. So today we are talking about, Claire's got two major topics that she likes to discuss. She loves talking about the idea of a registered counselor in South Africa, which is different from a psychologist. And we might get into that. I think there'll be some opportunity to kind of at least just define that and speak a little bit to the difference in experiences there. But today we are mostly going to be talking about mental health care in South Africa and particularly the massive difference between public and private care. And I think I'm really excited to hear from Claire what Claire's got to say about that. So maybe we could just start, Claire, by you telling my audience just a little bit about you, a little bit more than what we've got in the bio, and why this topic is of such importance to you.
Okay, so firstly, thank you for having me on the podcast. I am very excited. And you are absolutely correct. I did ask to collaborate, which, yeah, sounds quite forward. But really, I listened to a couple of your podcasts. I'm terrible at driving in silence, so I always like to have something on. And just that you're not afraid to discuss difficult, like you say, nuanced topics. And this is a topic that is really important to me and has become progressively more important to me through my work in public health. And I just thought, you know what? What a great opportunity to have this challenging conversation that probably highlights a lot of flaws in our public health system or in our health system in general. So that would be, yeah, kind of just to say thank you for having me on. And I'm really excited for our discussion as well. So why this topic? So obviously registered counselors, I'm a registered counselor, and having had the opportunity to work in the public sector, I've seen how that HPCSA designation can add so much value. And yet it's curious to me that, you know, the registered counselor designation has been around for like more than 20 years. And only of 2021 did they start formally employing registered counselors. So I think having these kinds of conversations, contributing to research, is really important to me. And then through that work, having worked in private practice and then now working in primary healthcare in state, I'm sitting with this stark discrepancy that I'm trying to like reconcile in my mind of really this disequilibrium between private mental health, or obviously all health, but specifically in my case, mental health, and then public mental health care. And I mean, I was reflecting a little bit today as to, you know, what my real reason is why I'm so passionate about this topic. And the one story that kept playing over in my head, I want to say it was the end of primary school, beginning of high school, around there. I was in a government public school, both primary and high school. And I remember this one day we had a group project or something. And this one friend of mine, it was something along the lines of, now it's giving away how long ago I was in school, but basically we had to work on this group project the next day in English. And she said to me, no, I won't be able to be there because I'm going to the doctor. So whenever I'd been to the doctor as someone who had private healthcare, you know, you book your doctor's appointment, you go to your doctor, and then you either go to school on either side of the day. So I was like, okay, but that's fine. But like, we can work before or after, you know? And then she said to me, no, I won't be at school because I'm going to be at the clinic. And this puzzled me at the time because I was like, but why are you going to be there the whole day? So she was like, no, well, we go there in the morning and we get seen when we get seen. And I remember that kind of being like the first sort of moment of like, hold on, hang on a second. This is different. So I think that was the starting point. And then I studied at the South African College of Applied Psychology, which has a very strong community focus, which really resonated with me. And then I've been working in public healthcare since October 2021. So, you know, working in areas like Elsie's River, Belleville South, Goodwood. So areas that, you know, unfortunately don't always have good access to service delivery. And seeing that discrepancy has been really hard to sit with.
Absolutely. I mean, I think in South Africa, we can't really speak about any of these discrepancies or differences in people's lived experiences without speaking to the history of this country and the legacy of, you know, colonialism and apartheid. So if you had to sort of sum it up, like, I mean, we don't want to go fully into the history and give a full history lesson, but just from your understanding, like, if maybe there's listeners who are international, they don't know the South African context, but also South Africans who maybe just don't understand what we're talking about here. How do you see how the history of South Africa plays out in the current inequality that we see?
Mm-hmm. So I think that's a fantastic question. And to give that kind of context is probably going to be a great springboard, actually, for the rest of our discussion. But sorry, I'm recovering from a bit of a cold. So we've got that fun, croaky, husky voice. South Africa, like many African countries, was colonized. I mean, that's not, you know, secret, hidden knowledge. That is what we're aware of. And that resulted in massive and significant power imbalances between, you know, the white man coming with the technology and the information from Europe, you know, coming and dominating the existing, there we go, I think we've got it, the existing people who were living and thriving here already. So power imbalances started then. And as years went on, wars were fought, and then apartheid came into being, which was yet another system that perpetuated power imbalance. And yes, apartheid ended in 1994 formally, but the reality is, after hundreds of years of oppression, and when you consider an intersectional approach, you know, it's not just racial oppression but gendered oppression as well. In the case of sexually diverse individuals, you know, we see oppression in terms of sexuality too, in terms of class. And as much as I'm proud to be part of the Rainbow Nation of South Africa, I'm also not one to stick my head in the sand and say that all has been resolved after things, you know, after we won the World Cup in 1995 and went from there. You know, it's not as rainbow and sunshine as it's painted sometimes. And I think, having done the work that I've done, especially as a white woman, you know, I've had the opportunity to see that, and it's not a pretty picture.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely what you're saying, but also just to like paint that picture is just to give everyone sort of the, I mean, maybe you have the actual stats in mind, but I think what's really important to understand here is that it was a white minority that ruled in apartheid. So it was the smallest part of the population, like a small percentage of the population, were the so-called ruling class. So the white Afrikaans government created systems that privileged and gave power and gave access to the white population, and at the same time dispossessed and denied access to the black population, who are the majority of this country. And now, since that has been disbanded and we had, our first democratic elections and everything that happened, we see a difference in that the white minority party is no longer the ruling party, and politically speaking, we have the African National Congress, who have up until recently been representative of the majority of this country. But what that means is that for the most part, it doesn't fit neatly along racial lines, but for the most part, there is an economic and class privilege that comes with being white. For the most part, it's not a hard and fast thing. And then for the most part, we have a large group of black and colored or non-white people in this country who are economically disadvantaged as well, and spatially disadvantaged because of how the apartheid government segregated people into particular areas of each province in this country. So what we end up seeing then is, particularly like maybe in the urban centers, they'll have like the higher concentrations of wealthier people, and for the majority in this country, that's not in all areas, but in a lot of areas, there'll be like a lot of white people in the rich areas, and then they will get private health care. And then there's this much bigger populations in poorer areas, particularly if you look at Cape Town. We've got huge informal settlements where there's people living in sprawling kind of ghettos, and they will have access to public health, which will be like, as you mentioned, clinics, which are often like mobile centers. They're often like prefab buildings, and not even like actual physical hospitals, not a lot of them. There are some public hospitals as well. And so what we're also looking at is a numbers game, really, which is that a huge majority of the people in this country are getting public health, and a smaller percentage are getting private health. But what that means is that there's the competitiveness in terms of getting seen by a doctor, getting seen by a specialist. You're working against the statistics, really, of the numbers that are at play. Maybe you want to speak a little bit to that. Maybe you have more stats than I have.
So, I mean, firstly, just as a little disclaimer before going into some numbers, because I did kind of consolidate a few, I'm not speaking on behalf of the Western Cape government in any way. I'm in my personal capacity. And it's really a discussion that, as the individual, right, is important to have, because it's not about assigning blame or, why don't we have enough doctors here or staff here or whatever. It's more just about identifying these challenges and working together to try and find solutions. So I just want to add that out there before I get fired when this is released. So look, in terms of quality of care, right, we can't begin to look at quality of care. I mean, obviously healthcare needs to be of a certain standard, that's a given. But we can't focus on the quality of healthcare if we have so many barriers to accessing this care in the first place. So considering things like transport safety, awareness of services, language barriers, mental and physical disabilities, in the case of kids, unsupportive caregivers. And I was recently wrote a paper with some colleagues, and the one statistic that stood out for me was that 80%, like you say, the large non-white majority make up most of that 80% of the population are accessing public healthcare services. And I mean, that's documented in several studies. And one of the studies being, I think I've got it here, Maya, Wisonge, and Madiba, 2022, they wrote a paper that speaks to the average of patients or people per psychiatrist in different areas. So, for example, the national average is one psychiatrist for every 66,000 people on average. Then in the private sector, it is one psychiatrist for every 20,000 people, which is still quite a bit. In the public sector, in more urban areas, it is one psychiatrist for every 263,000 people. And then in the public rural sector, it is one psychiatrist for every 3.3 million people. Or no psychiatrist at all. And that to me is, I mean, yeah, he wanted numbers. And I feel like it's quite profound.
Yeah, it's profound. Yeah.
So one can't see the picture of our healthcare system, our mental healthcare system, and not see that stark reflection of inequality and unequal distribution of services. I mean, even thinking back to, you know, apartheid days, the healthcare system reinforced, you know, psychology and psychiatry was part of what reinforced a lot of the oppression. You know, unfair, unregulated psychometric testing to, you know, re-emphasize this kind of sort of carnal nature, this uncivilized nature of non-white people, you know, taking these very European tests and reinforcing, well, okay, well, you're not meeting the standard on this test, therefore you must be uncivilized, you must be uneducated, not suitable for educating purpose, or suitable for not educable. Educable?
But I mean, I don't even think that they, I don't even know if they used those words exactly, but they went further than to say it meant that that those people were not able to be educated. Because I think nowadays we think of intelligence tests as being a measure to work out how educable people are. Yeah. Because it's actually being proven that it's more of a correlation between education than it is about actual intelligence. It's not really a good measure of intelligence, an IQ test. But I think what is even more destructive is they took people who maybe didn't speak English, who didn't get exposed to the kinds of learning that is required to you know, that is involved in an IQ test. And then they got a result that was below average or whatever it was, and they determined that those people were unintelligent, stupid. Mm-hmm. You know, they would use words like retarded, you know, in those days. That's how the tests were referred to, right? It was like mild mental retardation if you're under, you know, 50, 60 or whatever it was on an IQ test. No, it was under 100. Yeah, so I think it is, you're right. We have a very close history with, you know, that psychology has been, and psychiatry has been used by systems like the apartheid government. So I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, we won't even go into phenomenology and all of those things that we used to like determine. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, and it's not that long ago. Like, it was done in institutions that we could have studied at. You know, it was like Stellenbosch University, where they had like a department on phenomenology. Okay. So do you sort of want to speak to, is there any maybe other factors to consider other than apartheid and the historical relevance of these systems? I mean, maybe someone might say, okay, but the ANC government has had the reins for, you know, 30 something years. So surely they also could have improved the situation, or what, you know, what could have been done? Was there something that could have been done? Are there other factors to sort of speak to in terms of why we are dealing with this still today, all these years later?
Yeah. Look, South Africa is not rolling in money. And at the end of the day, a really harsh reality is that it takes money to not only offer services, but to train people to be efficient in offering, or, you know, sufficiently train people to offer these services. And I mean, when I think about, you know, just the psychology professions again, they are training so few clinical psychologists, especially because of the simple fact that they are not that many internship posts, because the internship post has to be at a psychiatric hospital. And we have so few of those, and they can't train more students, master's year one students, than they can accommodate interns. So, you know, something as, I don't want to say simple, but something as close to home for me and you as psychology professionals, there's just not money, right? And then you see it at a more grassroots level, where next to the hand towels in the bathroom, it says, you know, it's a big sign that says, budget cuts, please only use one hand towel per person, like those paper hand towels, like, please only use one. You know, it's little things like that. You see things that are broken that probably wouldn't cost that much to get fixed, but it's not on the priority list because, you know, they've got bigger fish to fry. And look, props to Western Cape Department of Health. I feel like they are doing perhaps more than other health departments in other provinces. You know, we definitely don't have the worst of it, if I can put it that way. But the reality is that, you know, when I speak to operational managers and people about challenges that I encounter as a result of, you know, lack of human resources, say, there's always so much to consider. You know, we just see, okay, well, this doesn't look like the service is being delivered, but there's so many layers and hoops and loops to jump through, and it all comes back down to money. Is there enough money? And then when you consider the fact that only 5% from the study, one of the studies I'm referring to, of the overall public health budget is spent on mental health. And then a strong sort of slant of those resources is actually directed towards inpatient care. So immediately now you're dealing with this very reactive mental health system, which is, okay, let's wait until someone is presenting with psychotic features, or is, you know, has, like, is actively suicidal or actively homicidal, you know, going out to go and murder their partner because they are past the point of prevention, past the point of promoting health, and it's now, okay, we need to act, rather than focusing on community-based interventions, you know, rather preventing illness and promoting health. But yeah, to my understanding, and this is what I've read, and I'm very open to learning, I don't purport to be the expert on these things, but as far as I understand, 5% is relatively on the lower end of the spectrum. I think the UK is more sort of 10 to 11% of their overall health budget, but it's not the worst. So I think there are countries that are spending less. But then you've also got to think, but yes, okay, so the US spends about the same amount as we do, maybe a little bit more. However, the number of people that our public healthcare system has to support, right? Especially considering the burden of disease of mental illness in South Africa because of things like poverty and other psychosocial factors. 5% is not enough. And especially when it is only in more centralized, what's feeding into more centralized, you know, your tertiary hospitals, your specialist hospitals, rather than at grassroots level where some of the clinics I work at only have a psychiatric nurse one day a week to see a whole community's worth of mental health patients. So then you say, okay, well, World Health Organization wants to decentralize mental health care. But are you? Where?
Yeah. Ask you a random technical question. You mentioned a psychiatric mental health, a psychiatric nurse. What was the psychiatric nurse. So if you take a psychiatric nurse's salary and you take a registered counselor's salary in government, which one is more affordable?
So,
you know, I mean, I don't even know.
I don't actually. I wouldn't be able to speak to that. But what I can speak to is that our roles are fundamentally different.
Different.
Yes. So the one is much more psychology focused, which would be the registered counselor. And then the psychiatric nurse is able to prescribe medications.
Okay,
so they performing a much more psychiatric function,
yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, I mean, because I think what I'm hearing you say, and I mean, I understand that to be the issue as well, is that, and I mean, I experienced this when I was training, was that, you know, they have a certain number of positions at quite a few different hospitals around the country for community service posts, which is the post you get after internship, where you, I think, I'm not sure if you know, if there's less community service posts than there are internship positions. Is that true? It's the same. Okay. Because I think some people like really struggle to get community service placements, but even so, the strangest thing is that they have placements for community service, but not for an actual full-time employee in that same hospital. So like when I did my community service and I was, there was one other psychologist in the department. She went on maternity leave. So I was the only employed person who was a psychologist, and I was in community service. And they were like telling me how they're going to really try and motivate to like open up a post, because, you know, up until that point they'd only had one post plus a community service post. And they were explaining to me how the government will rather have one permanent and one community service rather than two permanents, because a community service is a year-long contract, and they, like fiscally, like in terms of what they can afford in their budget, it is safer for them to have a year-long contract employee, because they could at some point potentially stop that if they ran out of money. But if you employ someone full-time, particularly in government, particularly in this country, you are almost kind of like beholden to them for the rest of their lives. like people kind of don't leave government once they're in it, almost. And so there was this like really big sort of thing of like, you know, there's just no permanent positions. Permanent positions are really hard to come by. But I was also just thinking that this is also part of the problem with this idea where like psychiatrists and psychologists are given such privileged position in the mental health sort of pyramid, you know, where there's this like hierarchical top down system where, you know, psychologists, psychiatrists are actually paid quite well in government. They get, which means it's a huge burden on the system to actually employ a psychologist or a psychiatrist. Obviously they do a huge amount of work and they're very, very educated, and, you know, they come with a big skill set. But everything that I've read, like about the World Health Organization's recommendations and everything that's been said about psychology in South Africa in the last few years, is that we need a totally different approach where it's more of like an upside down triangle, where we have the majority of people working at grassroots level in the community who are either lay people or people that have got, you know, relatively easy to access qualifications. I think registered counselors are, it's easier to become a registered counselor. There's not as many hoops to jump through. Is that correct? I don't want to say anything that's incorrect.
No. So definitely when you compare becoming a registered counselor with becoming a counseling or clinical psychologist or educational psychologist, there are far fewer hoops to jump through.
Right, exactly. And you don't have to, you have to do an internship, but you don't have to do a community service.
So how it works is you either do a four-year Bachelor of Psychology qualification, which is what I did, and that includes 720 hours of community service, but that is unpaid. So that's like an internship / community service sort of thing, but you get paid nothing in your fourth year.
Okay.
So you do that as part of your fourth year, which only became available after I'd finished studying, is the Bachelor of Psychology equivalent. Oh. So you would then do an undergraduate 3-year degree And then instead of an academic honors, you would do the BSc equivalent, which is 18 months. And that also includes the 720 hours of community service.
Okay. Right. So compared to what I did was to become a clinical psychologist was, you know, 3 years undergrad, a year of honors. So that's like a 4 years plus 2 years of master's. So that's 6 years plus an internship year plus a community service year. So that's 8 years in total before I could be qualified. Those last 2 years, I did get employed by the government in my internship and community service year. So that was remunerated, which helps. So it's only 6 years of unpaid education. And those are, you know,
Only six.
But I mean, yeah, it's a huge barrier of entry, especially why there's such a discrepancy in terms of, like, you know, we even see more of, you know, wealthier white people are more likely to become psychologists because of the fact that it takes so long and you have to study for so long without earning any income. But yeah, so for me, this really is like a curiosity. So if they know that they are the kinds of professionals that you like yourself or like, I don't know, you know, various lay counselors that could work in the public sector in community areas, why are they not adopting that system? Is it a system that they are going to adopt? Is this coming? Like, what do you think is going to happen here in terms of this?
So, super valid point that you've just made. And I don't think you are the only person to have thought of it, in that it is in discussions, especially with the discussions around the national health insurance, you know, that whole saga. The registered counselors, and I can only speak to the registered counselors, psychiatric or mental health nurses. Again, I don't want to speak to that and not have enough knowledge on it. But from what I've seen, and the mental health nurses I've had the privilege of working with, they are extremely competent individuals who add so much value to the mental health, the public mental health system. To be completely honest, I'm very surprised that medical aides have not cottoned on to this idea just yet, because how it works in government, and I don't know when last you worked at sort of community, like day hospital level, but how it works is patients will see the mental health nurse if there is, you know, any kind of further clerking that needs to be done or any kind of further investigation, or if the medication isn't working, then they get referred to see a psychiatrist. But once they're stable and on their medication, they follow up with the mental health nurse every couple of months and they reboard the medication, you know, do a full mental status exam, do brief containment and counseling, and they manage these patients. And should there be a red flag, immediately they refer up to the psychiatrist. So then we sit here in private waiting 4 months to see a psychiatrist, you know, and I'm thinking of cases where maybe there's like a depressed mood because of loss of a family member, right? A psychiatric nurse could quite easily do a history taking and, you know, prescribe medication and then say, okay, well, now follow up in 3 months with the psychiatrist when your appointment comes up, you know, just to initiate treatment. So nevertheless, that's a side note. When it comes to registered counselors, I think there's two major stumbling blocks. So the one would be that there isn't a lot of research on registered counselors. And the reality is that that's what government does or needs in order to make these posts available. So what happened in 2021, they created 9 in the Greater Cape Town Metro, 9 registered counselor posts, 3 in each substructure, for 3 year, or 2 in each substructure, for 3 year contracts. So again, we speak about the contract, which means that, like you say, they've got the budget for that 3 years. They know that if it doesn't work out, that NHI funding, when it ends, there's no commitment to renew it. So they did that. And then a portion of us were also voluntarily, we formed a part of a study. So there is a study going on at UCT. At the moment, where they are basically exploring and trying to understand how the registered counselor fits into this ecosystem. That being said, in 2023, they made a couple of permanent posts available for registered counselors. But if you wanted a permanent post, you had to then interview for it. So I went from my contract post, I was in open market, had to re-interview, go through the whole 6 month long interview process to now get my permanent post. So it was never a guarantee that you would get your permanent post. They would never just change the post. Apparently there's some legal something that they have to advertise the post to the open market as well. So now we have a couple of registered counselors who have just had their contracts renewed. And a couple of us have had the privilege of migrating into these now permanent posts through applying. The one factor, like I said, I think is research. There is not enough research as to what our role is. So that is the one element. And I think that kind of is furthered by the fact that lots of other health professionals don't fully understand our role either. So you've got psychologists, medical officers, nurses, OTs, social workers who are all working in the system and don't really understand the role of the registered counselor. They don't know how to use us effectively. So look, the research is now obviously going to start addressing that in some degree. And then I think the second part is, it's a big one because, and this isn't based in research, this is based in experience. Yes, I'm based at a number of primary healthcare facilities. But the work that I'm able to do is often so superficial because of my scope. And it's not actually what is required, if that makes sense. Some of the issues are because of the communities that we're serving are so severe already that I go in there and I'm like, okay, well, come, let's talk about some coping skills. Let's talk about deep breathing, right? Tell me, have you told your mom how you're feeling about the fact that she shouts at you? No, we are past that point. We're going into, you know, emerging personality features, and we're going into people who are already quite evidently psychotic and coming in with these very prevalent psychotic features. And all we're doing is containing and referring. And yes, there's value in containing, but I'm just thinking it's this, yes, registered counselors can add so much value, and I've seen the value we can add when those clients come, but there's just so much distress in these communities. I sometimes wonder, are we adequately equipped?
Yeah. I think it's a very valid point, and I think you kind of, you know, speaking to the experience of working in mental health in the public sector, which I think, you know, I might not be a registered counselor who feels that my scope is limited as a, you know, in terms of how it is understood. But when I was in that position in my community service year, I felt the exact same way as you, and it had nothing to do with the fact that I wasn't trained in a psychiatric condition. You know, I mean, just to, as you said, I don't know exactly what the difference is between all the different categories in South Africa. We've got so many different categories, even like between psychologists. Like, I don't even really know how to define what's the difference between a counseling and a clinical psychologist, except for the fact that I know that a clinical psychologist works very closely with psychiatry. And we were trained in multidisciplinary teams with psychiatrists. And what we are prepared to tackle are primary psychiatric diagnoses and conditions such as bipolar, mood disorder, you know, depression, schizophrenia. Like, we psychologists have a role to play in all of those disorders, and we diagnose and we treat and we use obviously evidence-based practices to try and manage symptoms. But my lived experience of working with these populations felt really similar to how you are explaining it, you know, that I also felt like with my skills that I was totally overwhelmed, and that the little tiny bit that I could do, and very often, especially in public health, you don't see people for repeat sessions. They're not coming for weekly therapy sessions like your clients in the private sector would. And so, you know, psychology was not designed to be done as a primary, I don't believe it was designed to be done in a primary healthcare setting where you see a patient once for an hour and that's it, you know, because what can you really do with a human being in a hour other than containment, or other than maybe it's like a small reflection on their experience that helps them to see that they have, you know, that should make meaning in a very, very limited way. But very often what I was experiencing was that, you know, these people were coming from contexts which were re-traumatizing them, that they, you know, I remember dealing with patients and the presenting problem was like, well, this patient has had diabetic foot and they'll have to have an amputation. And so they're being referred to psychology to deal with the grief of losing their foot. And then they would come in and talk about their lives. And it's like, gosh, your foot is really just the tip of the iceberg here. Like, we are dealing with a context that is rife with trauma where you do not feel safe. You don't feel safe. And I always think about like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Like, psychology is really about self-actualization, and it's right at the top. And we are dealing with people who have no security in terms of just the most basic needs. And we're here talking about feelings. And I think, so I have those same experiences, even though in a kind of different way. And I think that that's such a, I've worked with other people since being in private practice. I've worked with other people and they all come to me with the same feelings, having come out of their comserves. And a lot of people are very traumatized after their comserves. And the feeling is a huge amount of helplessness, a huge amount of overwhelm, a huge feeling of being disempowered, because here we are, these bleeding hearts that become, you know, caring professionals and work in these kinds of, you know, these spaces where we just want to help, but we just want to, you know, offer. And then you just feel so out of your depth and you feel so at a loss for how do you serve? How do you best serve, you know, this person in front of you, where you just think, gosh, you need so much more than what I can give you. It's quite devastating. And then you're working in a system, as you said, which is under-resourced, which cannot afford paper in the printer, let alone, you know, current psychometric tests or, you know, evidence-based interventions that are, or even just the idea of evaluation, like having a program that, like, in your department, all the things that you do are evaluated in a consistent way so that we can track what's working and what's not working. Even that doesn't exist, you know? And so you really do feel, I mean, it's so hard to be in that kind of system and to feel something other than a bit disillusioned, really, and disenfranchised. So anyway, I'm speaking a little bit to my own experience, but others as well. But that's so interesting to me that you're framing it in terms of being a registered counselor. And I'm like, well, I'm, you know, I went the whole nine yards and I still felt like that in comserve, you know.
I mean, Carly, that's firstly just very validating. I think it's interesting to hear such a, you know, someone in a different designation having had such a similar experience in similar environments. And I think to me, it's so fascinating how you say, you know, it almost leaves you feeling disenfranchised. And I just, part of me wonders how much of that, you know, we're experiencing, yes, but what that must mean for our clients, you know, the level of disenfranchisement that they must be feeling. It's almost like impossible to fathom, and, you know, to recognize how awful it is for us to sit there on this side of it being like, what on earth? How are you here? How are you surviving? And as awful as that is for us, we, you know, I recognize I get to go home at the end of every day. I get to step away from that reality for a period of time. And you're right. I mean, how much self-actualization can take place? And you said an hour. Primary healthcare level, we're instructed to do sessions of 30 minutes. So, yeah, like you say, I mean, they come in for one appointment. Quite a few of my patients do come back, you know, especially the ones that they're really, really committed. And to me, it's remarkable. But most don't. Most come for that one session. And I think that's actually also what stands out for me is that, you know, they'll talk completely, ball their eyes out, share, like, what do they call it on a TikTok? Trauma dumping or something of that variety. And they literally just unload. And by the end of the session, that's what was required, you know? So maybe I need to actually go and reflect on that a little bit myself, you know, in terms of the value that I can bring as a registered counselor. Granted, it's not maybe, you know, the clinical know-how and clinical knowledge, but perhaps that is something to reflect on.
Oh, I love that for you, that you're underselling the value that you bring, because you're imagining that because you have to refer, because of there being a psychiatric condition that needs to be attended to, that what you're offering is not of value. But I mean, I did my master's research on doula support. I don't know if you know what a doula is.
Okay.
Have you heard about a doula before?
I have. I think the first time was on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, where it was misnamed as a doily or something of that variety. So I went and Googled it afterwards to find out what it was. So I do know it's like a birthing coach,
like a birthing companion. So, you know, there's a lot of research about it and how effective it is and how meaningful it is. And they showed that there's very little difference between. So the idea about a doula is that a doula is there with a mother who's giving birth. We now have postpartum doulas as well. So that's like after baby's already been born. But the birth doula, which is what I researched, is someone who's there with you throughout your labor. So like as soon as labor starts, they stay with you and they are with you and they take care of the mother's needs. They support the mother through that process until baby's born and just after baby's born. And the research shows that the significance of the support, that having someone there, that the difference between someone who is skilled and someone who's just there is not that much. So we underestimate the significance that just having a human being be present with us and witness us and hold space. I mean, that's also a bit of a TikTok phrase, isn't it? But really just that idea of being there and the quality of being with someone in their experience, you know, that is significant beyond your actual instrumental help that you can offer them. So I think that speaks to the thing that you were just referring to, which is the idea that even if all they get is 30 minutes of getting their story told and having someone listening with an empathic ear and facial expressions that depict compassion and care, you know, that might be the one and only time that they've experienced 30 minutes of uninterrupted empathic active listening like that, and that is massively beneficial.
I think, you know, as you are saying, that might be the one and only kind of time that this is what, when they experience that. So many of my clients will come in, and obviously, you know, you kind of set the tone, kind of the two key foundations I always say is non-judgmental, confidential, you know? And as soon as I say the confidential part,
this podcast is recorded at Edible Audio in Cape Town, South Africa.
It's edited by Edible Audio. So this isn't going to get back to anyone. This isn't going to get spoken about. Okay, you're not going to judge me. Like, even if I say
this podcast is recorded at Edible Audio in Cape Town, South Africa.
Not here to judge. And I think,
edited by Edible Audio.
You know, sometimes maybe when
original music by Alex
loving parents, loving partners, healthy friendships, positive work relationships, we almost take that for granted. And when you're in an environment where that isn't present, it's like a treat. It's like something special, something. But yeah, look, I mean, at the same time, we're in the middle of that 30-minute, look, I stretched it to 45. Please don't tell my employers. But we're sitting often in a room that is not a designated space. You know, people are walking past the window and like looking in, and door has no lock. So people come in thinking that it's someone else. So there's interruptions. Like you said earlier, it's psychology, maybe not psychotherapy necessarily, but the idea of like the talk therapy in a primary healthcare environment is chaotic. You're kind of, you know, when I think about going to my own psychologist, it's this beautiful pastel colored, tranquil environment with the garden outside. You know, we're all calm and peaceful, mostly calm and peaceful. Sometimes I come in there like a bull in a china shop, but it's so different. It is so different. I mean, folders go missing. There was a time where I was sitting across from a client and the folder had, heck knows where it had gone, but that's the only point of reference. And, couldn't find the referral letters in the folder. So I'm doing the intake, blah, 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 and it was a younger child, sort of 10 years old, and mom was present at the request of the child. So respected that. I was like, okay, and tell me, you know, where does dad fit into the picture? Dad had died. Dad was the reason they had been referred. And I'm going with no information at all, completely blind, and in doing so, asked such a hurtful question that was not my intention, but it's just an ordinary question that I often ask, especially when speaking to kids. It's like, okay, who are you living with? I'm living with mom. Okay, cool. Where's dad? How does he fit in the picture? You know, what? No, no. You know, their mom starts crying and the child says, you know, dad died. So add on to that extremely long waiting list, minimal resources, like you said, just the layers and layers of trauma. You know, we've got mom comes in because her son has been shot dead in a mistaken identity. Okay, cool. Trauma, we start, you know, containing, we start working through bits of grief, we, you know, work on sort of recalibrating the nervous system a little bit. And then they come back the next week and they saw someone else's kid get shot dead in the street. How do you like there aren't words for that. So sometimes I think that, or I feel that all that one can do is just sit there in awe of the fact that these people are surviving. And then to top it off, they've had to sit on a 2 to 3 month waiting list to come and see someone who often doesn't speak their mother tongue, doesn't look like them, and comes from a privileged background. And I'm struggling to reconcile in my brain. I'm really struggling with that. And as a externalizer, I think that's probably why I wanted to have this conversation, because as uncomfortable as it is, I feel like this is how, even if these things don't get resolved, I feel like this is the kind of discomfort that needs to be had.
I think that's a really good point, because I think we reach for resolution and we think that, I mean, I think the mind, it's like, how do we grapple with grief? You know, we bargain, we try and work out if we could just go back in time, if we just did this differently and that differently. Over, I think the mind reaches for something to feel like it has control, really, in a completely chaotic world that makes no sense. And I think what you just said is so important, is that, and I think that that feeling, that experience of being in it and seeing all of this and feeling all of it, it's like you resolve it. You resolve to be unresolved. You say, okay, I can't resolve it. There is no resolving it. I mean, I think just being a white person, a white privileged person in this country is an unresolvable thing. You know, you go to the robots and there's people begging, and or you drive past, you know, the sprawling townships and you think about your lovely, comfortable life. And, you know, you just feel, it feels so complicated. And I think what I'm trying to say is that I recently asked the exact same question that you just asked to someone else, like, how do you resolve it? And they were like, I don't think you do resolve it, you know? And it was like, oh, yes, yes, I remember that now. You know, and you're like, it's like, I guess any sort of meaningful, enlightenment type experience, we sort of have to re-experience it again and again. Like, we don't just get enlightened once. It's like that lived experience, that unresolvable lived experience, continues to be unresolvable. We just sometimes forget and reach for something to try and resolve it and get reminded again that it's not resolvable, or that what is within our power, what is within our control, we can do things, you know, and we do those things, but that still doesn't resolve it. It's like I work with someone who's in the NGO sector. And, you know, it's, you don't go into that world unless you have a bleeding heart and you have an idea of how to solve a problem. And you go into it believing you're going to solve a problem. And then you end up realizing that all that happens is you going into a world where there is never a solution that solves all the problems. You'll solve this problem and these problems come with it. And in every way in South Africa, the systemic inequality gets perpetuated in every organization and every community, really. You kind of feel that same thing reoccurring. And yeah, I think you just have to go back to, okay, well, what am I doing? Well, I'm sitting in a room for 45 minutes being here. And that's what I'm doing. And it's not resolving necessarily this person's lived experience, and nor is it resolving my complicated feelings about encountering this person, but it is what I'm offering, and it is enough, and it's got to be enough in a way, you know, because I mean, there can always be that feeling in you, you're like, there must be more, and maybe some people are like really motivated to find the more, and maybe they do solve problems that maybe I won't solve because I'm not asking that of myself all the time. But I also have to weigh up my own mental state and my own obligations to everyone else in my life. And, you know, I think for most people, if you can find that good enough in yourself, if you can know that it's good enough for you, then that brings peace and it brings a sense of okayness, even if it might be temporary, until the next time you have an existential crisis, you know?
I think that line that you're sort of speaking about, that sort of dance over finding that balance, has been very tricky for me as a person who likes to do something. Okay, that's needing to be addressed in some way. Cool. Let me go do that. Let me try this. Let's talk about this. Let's see where we can do what we can. And there's been a lot of opportunity for that in the work or in the role that I've had. It's a new role. You know, there's been a lot of psychoeducation around the role, to staff, to patients. There's been a lot of implementing systems, you know, creating screening tools, streamlining referral processes, you know, effective screening, ways of sharing information, working between different departments. And then finding that balance, which I had to check myself in supervision a couple of times, where my supervisor was like, can you just calm down? Not every problem that you encounter needs to be solved by you. You know, you can take your foot off the gas, because if you want to be in this profession effectively for a long time, either as a registered counselor or a clinical psychologist one day, I don't know, we'll see. You can't be everything to everyone all at once.
Yeah.
And that's been a very challenging sort of, you know, because I can see, okay, well, look, you know, we could do this here. We could try this here. And I'm very passionate about a project. I love a project. I'm quite excitable, one might say. And I think that does make me effective in my role. And I've managed to solve a lot of, especially systemic, well, not systemic, but systems related problems, you know, efficiency wise, not systemic issues. So, yeah, but then there's that balance. There's that, it's kind of, I recently did the DBT immersion, which was amazing. So lots of my thoughts have been dialectical of late. And I think this is a classic example of it, is pushing for change, you know, not just relying on the system's broken. What can we do? You know, pushing for change, but also, like you say, knowing when it's enough. When it's enough to just be there with that person in the mess, whatever that looks like, however uncomfortable it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that different people have different skill sets, and you've got to know what you're here to offer and where you're best served, and to stick to that, you know, to not feel like you said you have to do everything for everyone. So we probably could talk more about different things, and maybe we'll have another chat. But I think just for timing wise, we should probably end off, because we don't want to go too long. Thanks so much for coming. It's been so nice to meet you and to hear your thoughts. And I think this conversation is really evidence that you can, that when you, I don't know, there's something about like-minded people. If you meet a like-minded person, you can connect and you can talk about things. And, you know, if you have shared experiences that sort of overlap, there's commonality. And it's so nice to actually hear from someone who's sort of doing something slightly adjacent, slightly different from what I do, but who I can really kind of connect with and understand. I can understand where you're coming from. Yeah. And may this also just be an example for everyone out there, that if you want to be on my podcast, you can just ask to be on my podcast. And, you know, give it a go, and also just ask for things you want in life. You know, why not? So thanks, Claire. Thanks so much for coming on the Couch with Carly, and we'll be in touch. And I will share Claire's details in the show notes so you can get hold of her if you have any questions or are interested in any of the things that she's doing. But yeah, thank you so much, Claire.
Thank you, Carly. It was such a treat. You've really given me a lot to think about, and I value that in these kinds of discussions. So thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to On the Couch with Carly. If something in this episode resonated with you or made you feel less alone, that means the world to me. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and now in video format on YouTube. For exclusive content and resources, visit our website at onthecouchwithcarly.com. If you enjoyed today's conversation, please consider leaving a rating or review. It really does help others discover our safe space for authentic conversation. Until next time, please take good care of yourself. I can't wait to be back on the couch with you again.